National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The fragile ceasefire in Gaza was briefly broken this week as Israel's IDF said it carried out heavy airstrikes against Hamas for what the Israelis said was a violation of the truce. This week on Register Radio, we talked with Sami Al-Youssef, CEO of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem. And then we have an update on the Louvre heist of jewels from Solène Tadier, who also tells us about the theological controversy over wandering souls. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm here in our Washington, D.C. studio with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Hello, Shannon.
Good to be with you, Matthew.
As always. Well, at least 100 people were killed by Israeli airstrikes, so the deadliest since the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas began on October 10th. The strike marked the most serious challenge to the fragile truce, but the Israelis put the blame on Hamas and what it says are Hamas's violations of the ceasefire deal. The question remains, what are the prospects for lasting peace, and what is the church doing in the Holy Land to assist so many caught in the crossfire? Joining us now is Sami Al-Youssef, CEO of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, who also wrote an important commentary for the Register, Will There Be a New Day After in Gaza? Stressing that the Latin Patriarchate is committed to a lasting peace and to caring for all citizens in the war-torn region. Sami, it's good to have you on Register Radio.
Thank you, Matthew.
Well, as your piece, your commentary asks, will there be a new day after in Gaza? And I guess that's where we can start. Where are we in terms of, from your viewpoint, and the prospects for peace in the Holy Land? And will the ceasefire hold again?
It is truly our hope that the ceasefire will hold. There's a lot at stake in many ways. However, it is a very shaky, I think, ceasefire in a sense, and we hope that both sides would really stick to the ceasefire because the road ahead is quite difficult and long. So if it does not hold now for, simple violations, will it hold in the future for, the bigger issues that are coming in phase two, phase three, and so on?
Right. And for those who may not be familiar with when we're talking about phase two, phase three, what are at least the expectations when we're discussing the peace terms?
I think the second phase will start to concentrate on the issue of the reconstruction, the issue of stabilizing Gaza, the issue of the full withdrawal of the Israeli army from Gaza, and putting in a mechanism for the governance of Gaza, and then moving onwards looking at the longer term prospects to stabilize the situation in Gaza and then onwards to the West Bank and hopefully reach some sort of a final peace arrangement between all parties.
Yeah. Sami, your piece for the Register was published a week ago, shortly after the ceasefire really took effect. And you focused in that piece on the Christians and others who have been sheltering at Holy Family Church, the complex in Gaza. And you described them being traumatized again when they got out and were able to move freely around into their neighborhoods. How were they traumatized again at that point?
I think during the war, of course, there was the destruction all around, but they could not in many ways venture out. They were sheltering in a relatively protected space, being the church, and it was very dangerous to get out of the church compound. And it wasn't until after the ceasefire that they were able to get out and go and try to find their homes. In some instances, they found their homes. In many instances, they could not even recognize the neighborhood where their homes were located, not even the streets, not even landmarks that were familiar to them before the war that were standing So it was, you know, a finality in a sense, you know, it was final. This is, you know, throughout the war, as they were sheltering, they were hearing, of course, all the explosions, all the news of the main destruction. But you still will always have that hope that maybe my home was spared, my neighborhood was spared, and what have you. So, you know, the finality of finding for most of them, I think the last count that we received from Gaza is like there is potentially about 25 families that found some standing structure out of the 145 families, Christian families that call Gaza home, in a sense. And even those, you know, had sustained, you know, moderate to major damage. So that's the trauma, in a sense. You know, all of a sudden you see that there is nothing left. It's not only that, you know, so the hope is gone of your belongings, at least, being there for you.
Yeah, Sammy, the scale of destruction, it, I'm sure, is simply inconceivable, is unimaginable for those who have lived this. From the standpoint of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, which has as its task the pastoral, spiritual, and material care of so many, what have the last 2 years been like for the Patriarchate trying to deal with disaster on this scale?
Incredibly difficult, I must admit, you know, because it is the most difficult, the longest, in a sense, two continuous years. And it wasn't only the war in Gaza, it's also the, you know, the issues that surfaced on the West Bank as well. So again, the West Bank is dealing with an extremely difficult set of conditions of settler violence, you know, lack of free transportation around, continued settlement activity, confiscation of land, you know, the construction of barriers all around the West Bank, in a sense, deeming most of these towns and villages, in a sense, enclosed on themselves. So, you know, I went to Zababdeh, for example, on Sunday, and again, you know, seeing it firsthand, you know, the major expansion in settlement and the number of checkpoints and roadblocks you have to cross. Sometimes you have to wait for 2 hours to cross, and so on and so forth. Let alone the economic ramifications of, you know, the high unemployment as a result of the war. So we're not only dealing with Gaza and, you know, that, you know, dire humanitarian situation, but we're also dealing with a very, very difficult situation that is evolving on the West Bank. And, you know, the support, you know, ranges anywhere from, you know, strengthening the pastoral offerings as a church. You know, you need to, you know, concentrate on the faith formation, you know, to strengthen people inside so that they will continue to have that hope, really, to be able to face it all around them. And certainly, you know, a major, major expansion in our humanitarian offerings. You know, anything you can think of, we've done it over the past 2 years, including job creation possibilities on the West Bank, including, you know, cash distributions, food coupon distributions, support in, you know, tuition payment in schools and universities, medical support, and so on and so forth. So the load really on our staff has increased dramatically, but we're quite happy to be able to do as much as we've done.
Sammy, on that, in that regard, are you concerned that the international community will look at this ceasefire and basically think that the crisis is over for the people in Gaza?
I certainly hope not, but it appears that in some circles, yes, a ceasefire is on, so you turn your attention somewhere else. Although, you know, in reality, if you look at the reconstruction for Gaza, you know, you're talking about the potential of this taking decades to complete and, you know, rebuild the infrastructure and, you know, all that is lost. So indeed, I think, you know, just like, you know, the false conception, really, that it all started on October 7th. Again, you know, maybe we may be in for a false conception really today that there is a ceasefire and it's over. It is not over. It has not been over for decades and through many, many crises over the past decades, intifadas and wars and so on and so forth. And unless really the international community concentrates on dealing with the core issues and solving the Palestine-Israel issue and, you know, for people to get to the point where there is peace and justice and, you know, equality and life and dignity for everyone, then I'm afraid, you know, this may be another good potentially be another lost opportunity, and you know, things will quiet down temporarily, and then you'll have another flare up in a year or two or 10 or whatever it is.
And it's not just roads and buildings that have to be reconstructed, Sammy. In your commentary, you emphasize that the Christian values of coexistence, forgiveness, reconciliation, that these are all part of rebuilding. How do you realistically see those values being embodied in a hopefully post-war Gaza?
We have to, and this is the more difficult part, in all honesty. I mean, you get the money, you get the funding, you're able to, you know, fix the stones, but how do you fix the living stones when they're deeply sort of traumatized to the limit? And you have to take it one step at a time. You can't expect to rebuild the human values. You can't expect to build the people-to-people relations overnight, in a sense. So there has to be a process. And that process has to start, and the church has an extremely important role to play in that process as we move forward.
Yeah, and one of the questions that's often asked is, what is needed to try to convince the Christians in the region to stay? And I know in your piece for the Register, you talk about that we will not encourage people to stay or leave. This was always considered a personal choice, and no one should be in any position to judge. The question, I guess, is what is needed most at this point to try to give them what they need, but also to try to give them a sense of hope for the future?
Sure. I think the Latin Patriarchate historically in Gaza, at least, have done job creation projects. We've been involved. I mean, up leading into the war, we had the largest job creation project of all targeting our Christian youth in Gaza. We had over 64 people employed before the war. So jobs, education, and housing. I mean, these are the three main areas. People look at education as sacred in our community. As a matter of fact, when His Beatitude went on his very first visit to Gaza in May 2024, parents were asking him to resume some educational process before he even considers sending humanitarian supplies. That's how much people value education. So we have to, you know, concentrate on rebuilding our educational enterprise in Gaza. We have two schools of the Latin Patriarchate in Gaza and another, a third Catholic school, the Rosary Sisters School. We have to concentrate on rebuilding those educational institutions first. We have to look at housing possibilities to sort of give people a dignified place to live post-war, and certainly job creation. We have to reestablish our presence in job creation. If people have those, you know, basic sort of needs, then the likelihood of them leaving, I think, will be reduced in a sense, because, you know, at least they have the basic minimum to look for.
Yeah, well, Sammy, we are all very much aware of the enormity of the task that you've been through, but also that's ahead for you. And know that all of you are in our prayers and will remain there.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
And we look forward to having you back, if you're willing, to give us updates and to keep us aware of what's happening in the region.
Certainly, I'll be pleased to do that.
All right. Well, Sammy El-Youssef, CEO of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, thank you again for your time.
You're most welcome.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next, we talk to Solène Tadier for an update on the Louvre Jewelry Heist and the controversy over wandering souls. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen here with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. We are tracking one of the stories that has really riveted news watchers for the last week or so, the stunning jewelry heist at the Louvre Museum in Paris. Late this week, French authorities announced further arrests. And Register Europe correspondent Solène Tadier has been covering this story for EWTN News and has the latest. Solène, thank you first for coming back and giving us an update on this. I know this has been a fascinating story, even from a Catholic standpoint.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. On different level, actually, for France, it's a disaster because from a heritage point of view, and like I said, you know, it happens in the worst possible time for France because we already have all this government instability, all these crises happening. And right at that time, one day before our former president was jailed, we had like this terrible symbol happening at the Louvre Museum. I mean, that's supposed to be the most protected museum in the world. And on Sunday morning, you had these helmeted men, you know, wearing these yellow jackets, and they literally went there at 9:30, like life is good. And like visitors were entering the museum, and they used a furniture lift that they stole a few days before. And that was already reported. And so they stole these furniture lifts outside just outside Paris. And they reached the first floor window and broke in and stole 8 pieces of jewelry, including that famous reliquary brooch of Empress Eugenie, that was the wife of Napoleon III. So it's a piece of immense artistic and spiritual significance. What is maybe we can also explain why, because the term reliquary engraved on the pin is intriguing in itself, and it has always intrigued historians because it does not visibly contain relics, but it may have hidden a compartment on the back of the brooch, likely meant to host one. And so that's the conclusion that the Louvre experts had and published. And it's a reflection of course, that the Empress really authentic devotion. She was deeply Catholic. It's not a very well-known fact nowadays, because she's known for being a fashion icon, for having inspired architecture, fashion, all the lifestyle of France that then spread around the world. But she was also, in her own time, she was called Ministry of Charity. And because she would fund so many hospitals and parishes and charity initiatives. So she was very much beloved by the people for that reason. She had very strong devotion to the Grotto of Lourdes, and that was exactly when the apparition appeared. She intervened to keep the grotto open because at the time there were so many people going to the grotto that the authorities feared that it could cause some insecurity. So they wanted to close the grotto, where she intervened so that it would not happen and that people could still benefit from all the miracles from the grotto. So that made her popular in her time, and people don't really know that today. So that brooch really symbolizes all that.
What's the latest from French authorities? Do we have suspects in hand, and is there any chance of the jewels actually being recovered?
Yes, absolutely. So we have the latest news today from the authorities of France. So 5 new people have just been arrested, including one that is suspected to be one of the actual robbers. 2 earlier suspects were charged with organized theft. They are like age 34, 39, and they are already in pretrial detention. They are quite confident that they're going to find the whole team, because they found some DNA traces that helped identify one of the presumed robbers. And so there are not yet any track of the actual jewels, but if they're able to find the whole team of robbers, then we can have a hope to track down these jewels, especially since they're not going to be so easy to sell. If the jewels are not yet dismantled, then there is at least a little hope to find them, and it would be something very important, because this piece of jewel literally symbolizes 3 centuries of the history of France between Louis XIV, Marie Antoinette, and Napoleon III. I mean, that's an absolutely crucial piece of our history.
It's a fascinating story, Solène. We're all riveted by it, as we are with another piece that you have up on NC Register. .com right now, titled Wandering Souls or Demonic Masquerade: Why This Debate Is Still Stirring Exorcists and Theologians. This discusses age-old questions about life, death, and the mystery that unites both. So Len, this is one of the pieces that are going to be featured in the Register's upcoming death issue, which is a great collection of stories looking at death and dying, but really the understanding, the Catholic understanding about death and the end of life and the life beyond. What is your story focusing on specifically?
Yes, like you say, Shannon, it's a very sensitive topic, and it's causing a lot of like very emotional reactions from both sides. And I think our role as Catholic journalists is not to pick sides, but really trying to stay focused on the Catholic doctrine, but also understand what is at stake and understand the tension here. Like, people genuinely wanted to understand the mysteries around death and what happens next. And also the Church very legitimate attempt to maintain, not to take risk, because her primary mission is of course the salvation of souls. But what is very important is that some key exorcists are really making this theory, including Fathers Javier Luzon Peña and José Antonio Fortea, who are literally the most famous exorcists in Spain. And so basically they claim to have encountered on their field experience souls that they think might not be demonic deceptions, but real souls in purgatory that were probably already saved. So they are not questioning the doctrine of immediate judgment after death. But they say that's probably souls that are already saved, but that are in between two worlds, that's, and they're asking for prayers. And what makes them think that they've found some real humility in them, and like a desire to request prayers. So it's something very interesting. So the International Association of Exorcists absolutely rejected this idea, because they think it could confuse believers and encourage spiritual risk, because if they think, oh, they could also contact some dead people, if they see any strange phenomenon, they can confuse that and try to get in touch with these entities, and that can be extremely dangerous. But the Spanish exorcists insist that you can call heresy something that is only a hypothesis. And so I tried to understand that as a Catholic journalist, and I asked this other Belgian theologian, Arnaud Dumouche, who explains that this theory can be completely coherent with the Catholic doctrine as long as we understand the difference between two understanding of death, that is the clinical instantaneous event, like when the heart stops, and death as a process, a passage, also as mentioned by Pope Benedict very briefly in Spes Salvi. And like people who are already admitted to salvation, that are already saved, but when they die, they have this long process, and they can maybe under God's permission appear close to the world to ask for intercessory prayers. So it's a tricky topic, and I thought it would be important to address it, because a lot of Catholics, especially among the young, you know, a lot of people are not properly catechized, and they are going to seek answers elsewhere. And I think it's very important nowadays that the Church really answers these questions, exorcists and theologians, without being too emotional. I think we, like believers today, really need and deserve this.
Yeah, well, Solène, you have a whole section of your report on a pastoral risk, and you talk about the danger that might be there of that many people who believe to have received manifestations of deceased relatives are in fact victims of demonic deception. And I know you talked to one exorcist in France who weighed in on this as well. Can you, as we're drawing to a close for today's episode, but can you sort of summarize what he said and leave us with a really important point about the Church's teachings on Christian hope?
Yes, you're really right. It's a very important clarification. I was happy to interview Father Cario from France, from the Basilica that hosts actually the Holy Tunic, and we wrote several pieces about that. And he thinks that it's interesting, and he said, I understand that some exorcists can also make theories and try to understand what they see from the ground, but he says it's important to not mislead believers. And he thinks that somehow, if although it's not, it does not contradict the Catholic doctrine, it can maybe induce confusion among the faithful. Like maybe they might have a second chance at the moment when they die, like maybe not really choosing God for their whole life and saying, oh, anyway, when my heart stops, you know, I can also still decide that I want to choose God, but I didn't do so my whole life. And as it you have like your second chance when your heart stopped, and he said, it's a risk that the church cannot take right now. The fact that's implying that yes, you can somehow not really choose, and like because the church's primary goal is to claim the urgency of conversion, the call to holiness in this life, not after our heart stops. Right. So I think it's
And the point you made too is, as you write, the church firmly teaches that Christian hope rests not on speculation, but on communion. So yes. A very important point. So, well, Celine, a fascinating report, and I look forward to having you on again.
Thank you so much. My pleasure as usual.
Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care and God bless.